The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth. Now, we've had a big Commons vote today and it's not been on COVID, which is quite unusual. It was a vote on the government's decision to cut international aid spending from a target of 0.7% of gross national income to 0.5%. And this was very controversial. It was something that the government had resisted giving MPs a vote on, despite it being in the Conservative manifesto. And last night, the Treasury sprung it on MPs that they were going to be holding this vote. And today, the vote passed. So the government won. They won 333 votes to 298, and there were 25 Conservative rebels. James, were we expecting that size of a revolt?
So I think the government's majority in this vote was actually slightly larger than most people would have expected this morning. It's worth remembering that when Andrew Mitchell had previously tried to force a vote on this, Andrew Mitchell, who's a former chief whip as well as a former development secretary, told the Commons that if it had come to a vote, they would have won, the rebels would have defeated the government with a majority of at least nine. So I think the size of a government's majority, you know, looks fairly comfortable. You say government majority of 35 and you think, what's the fuss about? But then, as you say, you've got 24 Tories voting against the government, 14 of whom are former ministers. And you've got the former Prime Minister Theresa May being one of them, Jeremy Hunt, the former Foreign Secretary and Boris Johnson's rival for the Tory leadership, being one. And you see, I think, a problem for the government whips coming down the line, which is that this group of former ministers is essentially unwhippable. They aren't interested in preferment and they aren't really interested in ministerial office, or if they are, they're only interested in ministerial office on their own terms. And then I think compounding that, something that came across in Theresa May's speech, is, you know, they all remember that Boris Johnson voted against freeline whips in the past himself, most notably on Theresa May's Brexit deal. And so there's an element of, don't tell me to do that when you did this to me. And I mean, that is a problem. I mean, you know, the sense that Theresa May is perfectly willing to be a critic of this government from the backbenches, and when a former prime minister criticises the government of the day of their own party, it is always going to make news, is an issue for the government. And I mean, you can see with some more difficult votes coming up in Parliament over the coming years, I suspect, you know, the whip's office should be breathing a sigh of relief rather than of elation tonight.
I thought it was interesting that you had lots of senior figures speaking in the debate. And as you say, Theresa May gave a forceful speech where she talked about knowing what it was like to suffer rebellions on her own side, but then said that this government was pursuing a policy that would mean, and I quote, more of the poorest people in the world will die, which is quite a strong line for a former prime minister of the same party to take. But I thought what was really interesting was, aside from those senior people, you didn't have the kind of usual keen, eager, ambitious backbenchers who will turn up when the whips tell them that they're in a sticky situation in the Commons and give a gratingly loyal speech about how wonderful this government is. There weren't very many of those. And you could either say, well, that's because the government was in real trouble. But given the result, I think it shows that actually the whips knew they had the numbers early on and that they didn't need to dispatch the brown nose squad to help them out in the chamber. They could just let this take its course. I thought it was interesting also, having watched Boris Johnson be very dismissive of the rebels in the Commons over the past few months. So last week at Prime Minister's Questions, he basically took the mickey out of them, saying that they hadn't taken the opportunity they were given to use the estimates vote to vote on this aid cut, which the rebels said was completely unfair because the estimates vote wouldn't have allowed them to express their view about the cut from 0.7 to 0.5. But anyway, today Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, did the wind-up in this debate, and he went out of his way to praise the conscience and the, how, you know, the wonderful speeches given by every single rebel. And then after the result, having won, he then got up and gave another speech, which almost sounded like the government had lost, where he was saying that, you know, this vote underlined the government's commitment to international development. So he was really sort of charming his way through all of this. And I don't know what you think, James, but it's an interesting approach for a chancellor to take. And I wonder how long it's going to be sustainable with less popular cuts and tax rises that are inevitably coming down the line in the next few months. Most chancellors try to be slightly scary, slightly aloof. You think of the public image that George Osborne, who in private is quite a warm and interesting fellow, but that sort of austere public image that he cultivated in the early years of the coalition in order to basically get the cuts through that he needed to do. He didn't want to appear to be his colleague's best friend because he needed to be able to tell them difficult things. And I just wonder whether this different, charming approach from the Chancellor is going to work, whether it's, you know, a new and clever way of doing it or whether he's being a bit naive.
So I think one of the reasons is the government peeled off rebels with something of a compromise, but they have committed in principle to 0.7. They've said that when the current budget is balanced and debt is falling as a percentage of GDP, then they will restore the 0.7. So I think one thing they were trying to do, and remember the 0.7 is a Tory manifesto commitment, it is to depict this as, and this is something that Andrew Mitchell and David Davis and several other the rebels hotly disputed, but depict this very much as a temporary cut. But this isn't a great ideological battle over. And I think this also might be part of the explanation for your point about the lack of backbench speeches. They didn't actually want to make a kind of principled argument saying we shouldn't be sending this money overseas when we've got problems at home, kind of that kind of classic anti-foreign aid argument. Because they're trying to argue that this is just a temporary measure and that as soon as the public finances are back on this sustainable footing, 0.7% will be restored. So I think that is the explanation for the tonal approach today. And I also think it's one of those things which is that from the government's point of view, it would have been dangerous to kind of poke the hornet's nest, if you see what I mean. I think that quite a few MPs went through, I mean, the MPs don't go through the division lobby anymore, but in this pandemic parliament, but quite a few MPs backed the government, I think, with a certain reservation. I think if the government had said, ha, we are winning this vote, that might have backfired. So I think it's a tactical question about this. As you say, though, there is a fascinating question about what happens come the spending review, and not to return to the subject of our Saturday discussion as well. But, you know, when you look at the size of these backlogs in health in particular, most dramatically with Sajid Javid talking about a possible 13 million person waiting list, the criminal justice system, education, you know, you can see a whole series of arguments coming up about where the government spends money. And I thought it was interesting that in Boris Johnson's opening speech, he kind of tried to argue that there was inevitably going to have to be some difficult decisions taken, given how much money the government has spent during the pandemic. And I thought that was the first time we've heard from him an attempt to argue that, you know, that there will have to be some belt tightening because of the steps that were taken during COVID with, you know, furlough, business support grants, the money spent on test and trace and all those other things.
How likely does this backdrop make social care reform? Just to move on to another thing that's been discussed today, it was Sajid Javid's first health departmental questions in the Commons, and he talked about his three priorities as health secretary, and one of them was launching what he described as full proposals, a full plan for social care reform. Now, given how many difficult decisions there are that the government has to make, and given this is one of those things that governments have over the past 20, 25 years talked about having to make but then not made because it's so unpopular to talk about how much money people are going to have to put into this system. Is it not going to be the case that we're just going to get some proposals that will never, you know, they might even make it onto the statute books like the Dilnop proposals, but actually never really be implemented?
I think this is a very interesting question because Sajid Javid talked about us putting social care on a sustainable footing today. Now, sustainable means you have to have a way of funding it going forward. That can't just be borrowing more money. Yet the Tory manifesto rules out any increase in income tax, national insurance or VAT. So how are you going to fund it? And then I think you get into a problem, which is, I think COVID has exposed, it's going to shone a heart, put a spotlight on the flaws in the social care system. One of which is clearly the use of low paid agency staff who work in multiple homes. I think most people agree that that is one of the things that initially led to the virus spreading among care homes. But then you come back to the fact that the Tory manifesto commitment on social care is not actually to deal with that issue. It is to deal with the issue of people having to sell their house to pay for care, which, as you say, Isabel, pushes you towards DILNOT and some kind of cap on care costs, which is a very expensive policy. So I think throwing that into the mix now, you can see that the political need to solve the problem has risen, but the solutions have become more difficult because the problem is such a multifaceted one.
Well, we'll definitely be talking about that and lots of other difficult decisions in podcasts to come for quite a long time. James, thank you so much, and thank you to everyone who has listened to this.